I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. On our bloggers' roundtable, Detroit's mayor can't seem to shake calls for his resignation. Also, the Supreme Court hears a landmark case aimed at gun control. And should the world's oldest profession become a legal way of doing business? Joining me now to make sense of it all, Ambra Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com. Also, Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. Hi, folks.
How are you doing?
Hello.
Hello.
So let's start with a topic dear to your heart, Eric, your city's mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick. The calls for his resignation seem to be getting louder and louder, and they have been getting to the mayor himself. During his State of the City address last week, he went after the city council and the press.
This unethical, illegal, lynch mob mentality has to stop. We've never been in a situation like this before, where you can say anything, do anything, have no facts, no research, no nothing, and you can launch a hate-driven, bigoted assault on a family.
This reminded me a bit of Clarence Thomas's high-tech lynching quote. What does it call up for you, Eric?
Well, for starters, I think that the mayor of Detroit needs to get in front of a mirror and ask himself whether or not he bought this all on himself, which he has. The text messages, which is a minor thing in this whole deal, because the text messages, number one, prove that he lied on the witness stand along with his chief of staff. But for him to get up there and blame the media for saying that they are responsible for going after him with this lynch mob mentality is ridiculous. And anyone that is from Detroit, I mean, I was born and raised in Detroit, I don't live there any longer, should be embarrassed that someone is representing them in this way. He bought this all on himself. Therefore, you pay the price for being a person that is ungodly. And I say that because he constantly wants to say that he is on a mission from God or has been selected by God to become mayor of Detroit. How disingenuous is that?
Ambra, his mother is the head of the Congressional Black Caucus. I'm talking about Congresswoman Carolyn Cheeks Kilpatrick. It's got to be an awkward position. But, you know, Kwame Kilpatrick is part of a political dynasty. And do you think that that plays at all into how he views his role in government?
Absolutely. I think that originally I think there was intent to sort of set him up to be, you know, the great black hope in a lot of respects in politics, you know, that he could go pretty far into Congress and even potentially into the presidency. But I have to agree, you know, I think that with a, you know, previous person that just commented that I think
Eric.
That yes, thank you, Eric. I just have an issue with, I mean, as far as him telling everyone else that they can do and whatever they want to do, I think he thinks that he can do whatever he wants to do because he has been the golden child in so many respects. But I mean, I have to say, I think that the writing's on the wall on this one.
Now, Jay, there have been calls for his impeachment, for his resignation. We've talked about this on the show before, and there's, you know, there's a question of whether or not African American voters are willing to step up and really push for the removal of a black elected official, or if that is too painful. Do you think that the electorate will end up backing away from some of the support that's existed so far?
I would think at some point there has to be a backing away. I mean, I think it's only natural, given the long history of persecution of African-American leaders in this country, the people's first instinct is to give them the benefit of the doubt and back them up. But I think the longer that this goes on and you see the tremendous sense of entitlement that he has and the hubris that he has about seeming to think he can get away with anything, as you saw even in his text messages where he says, "I'm the mayor, LOL," as if he's untouchable. I think I think eventually they have to see that. I mean, we see the story of this woman, Tamara Green, who may or may not have been at this party in the mayor's mansion and later was killed. And I think, you know, beyond how that fits into this soap opera, the real tragedy of that is it's one of so many murders that have happened in Detroit. And there's so much crime and poverty and serious issues that they're facing. And the longer that Kwame Kilpatrick stays in office, the longer he perpetuates this soap opera and takes resources and attention away from all the serious issues Detroit is facing. So I think after a while, the public has to get tired of that and get ready for things to change.
Eric, give us a little bit more detail on how the Tamara Green investigation is playing out. This was a murder case involving a woman who, according to some reports, may have performed as an exotic dancer at the mayor's mansion. There's obviously a lot of he said, she said, they said in this, but what are people drawing from the published news reports on this?
Okay, what people are drawing from is the fact that the rumor never died. This is an event that took place, you know, years ago, and here we are in 2008 still talking about it. And there's a reason why the rumor even existed to begin with. Some rumors just die slowly, some die fast. This has been an ongoing issue, and the rumor has become so much more believable based on the fact that here you have a guy that is the mayor of the city, and to piggyback just a little bit, even in 2005, he was only elected with 117,000 votes in a city of, 900,000 people. So there is a sense that a lot of people have already checked out on him. So, and to get back to Tamara Green, is the fact that why is it that the rumor never died? Well, when you get on the stand and you tell a lie, the sense of the people is, what else is it that you may have lied about? And when you have someone has come forward to say that I saw a police report of Tamara Green turning into the police saying that I was beat up by the mayor's wife, that further validates the rumor to become more believable.
Well, we're going to leave that alone for now. It is playing out in the news media, but there is a lot of speculation. I want to say that. But I want to move on to something that is, people call it the world's oldest profession. We're talking about prostitution. Of course, the New York governor, Eliot Spitzer, former New York governor, resigned after being completely swamped with allegations that he'd spent $80,000 on prostitutes. Kristen was the name for the high-end prostitute he allegedly slept with. Her legal name is Ashley Alexandra Dupre, and you can go on to MySpace and listen to her music. So, all that aside, Ambra, let me start with you. I want to ask you about different options around prostitution. One is to keep it illegal, but in the U.S., prostitution is effectively legal in certain cases in two states, Nevada, Rhode Island. In Rhode Island, you can pay for sex if it takes place indoors. Don't ask me why. And in parts of Nevada, brothels are allowed by law. So, what about the other 48 states? Do you think people should reconsider, given how much prostitution there is in the U.S., do you think that states should reconsider or municipalities should reconsider whether or not it should be legalized or decriminalized?
Absolutely not. I don't think that the prevalence of anything in our society is licensed to legalize it. I think that there are aspects of prostitution that are harmful to society, harmful to the individuals, and I don't necessarily think that legalizing it is going to help anything.
Now, Jay, in the Netherlands, prostitution is considered a legal profession, just like being a teacher or a police officer. They have the right to unionize, run ads for their services, collect government benefits, and they have to get an extensive amount of medical testing. Are there some goals, like health goals around the spreading of AIDS and STDs, that might be in conflict with some of the other goals, like let's not have prostitution at all? And how do we as citizens and the government make decisions about which goals are foremost?
I mean, I think it's a complicated question, and I see disagreement even among feminist and women's groups on the best way to handle it. But I think the reality for most people in the sex industry is a lot less glamorous than people who are working for the Emperor's Club. And I mean, it's an industry that's very exploitative for the women who wind up as sex workers. And I think whatever laws we have in place should be set up to protect those women from exploitation rather than persecuting and shaming them. And I think maybe decriminalizing, if not straight up legalizing, would go a long way towards making sure those women are protected.
Eric, before he was deposed, Spitzer worked on legislation around trafficking, around taking girls and women and bringing them into the U.S. for prostitution. Arguably, legalizing prostitution would also undermine trafficking. Do you buy that argument?
Well, to a sense, but that was Spitzer's major problem. You are policing something that you, in turn, get caught up in. And I think if you're going to legalize it, one of the things that's very important to do is find a way whereas both the John and the prostitute are prosecuted equally. And I think that's one of the major issues a lot of feminist groups have, is the fact that you prosecute the women vigorously and the Johns get, you know, these misdemeanors. And that's not fair if you're going to have a situation where, okay, it's illegal, so why is it that the men are not being prosecuted as much as the women?
All right. If you're just tuning in, here's a quick rundown of who's on the line for our bloggers roundtable. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. You were just hearing from Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog. We've also got Amber Nicole, who blogs at Nicola.com, and Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. I want to move us on to another controversial topic. This is going to hit the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. District of Columbia v. Heller revolves around an individual's right to keep a licensed handgun in his or her own home. The Second Amendment case is complicated because it involves Washington, D.C., which is not a state. D.C. has some of the strictest handgun laws on the books, and some observers are concerned that if this case overturns D.C.'s handgun prohibitions, it could mean serious problems with gun violence on the city streets. So, Jay, let me ask you about this case. In terms of the rise and fall of gun violence on the streets, what happens if the court effectively says D.C. citizens should be licensed to keep handguns at home for self-defense? Does that change the game, make the city more dangerous?
Not living in D.C., it's hard for me to say definitively, but I think I'm always ambivalent about this because I think we need as many controls as we can to limit the use of guns, but I feel like America just has such a deep-seated cultural connection to guns and violence that if people really want guns, they're always going to find a way to have them. And you know, I would be hesitant to tamper too much with the Constitution in order to try to stop something that just runs deeper than that. So, I think we should do whatever we can within the law to make sure that there are limits and things are being handed out properly. But I don't know. It's hard for me to say. It's a tough question.
Now, what do you think, Eric? Do you think that the link between gun control and gun violence is clear and strong? It's been debated a million times.
Well, growing up in Detroit, where at one time we were known as the, you know, murder capital of the world, it's a very difficult issue because, you know, look at Dick Heller. He has a gun every single day when he goes to work, and he has to leave that gun somewhere on his way home. And it's also about the matter of being able to protect your family. D.C. is also a high-crime area, and it's sort of like a contradiction to not allow someone that works every day with a gun to not let him take it home. So gun controls are what they are, but just like Jay said, people find a way to get guns, so some laws that are on the book kind of don't make sense to begin with.
Amber, how do you fall on this? I mean, there's so many different facets of it. There's what is legal, there's what is possible, that is, you know, people are able to take assault weapons across state and county lines, even when they're not legal. If you're involved in gang violence or you want to purchase an illegal weapon, many times you're able to get it. And there's what's moral. How do you, again, since we're talking in this broad level about making decisions as citizens that affect other people, how do you make a decision about how you fall on this?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, the one thing America refuses to do on this issue is to really look at human nature and the people who are behind the guns. And I think that, you know, regardless of if we take them off the streets or whatever the case may be, people will find a way to exhibit violence towards one another. It does scare me a bit to not have any guns at all. I mean, to be moving towards a society where, you know, average citizen can't carry a handgun, especially looking at the economy and some of the things that are to come. It's interesting to see, you know, I think that weapons might be of a lot more of importance in the future than they are even now. So
it's like that saying, an armed society is a polite society. You believe that?
I think I do to some degree. I think I don't think we're dealing with the root issues. I think there's a lot. I think gang violence stems much deeper than having whether or not they have guns. I think it has a lot to do with lack of fathers. I mean, so many different things. So in any case, I just don't think that this is the big issue.
Eric and Jay, do you think that the issue of guns really is much more a fundamental issue about how we operate morally within this society, and that the gun issue is just secondary or tertiary? Eric first.
It's secondary because there are, it's secondary. Matter of fact, maybe even tertiary, because look at so many other issues, drugs and, you know, just like Amber said, the lack of fathers in the household. So there are more other issues more prevalent than just having a gun, because, again, I just go back to the fact that if you want to get a gun, there's a way to get them. So,
Jay, what about you? How important is it for you to focus on issues like gun control versus other issues that are affecting urban communities?
Oh, well, I think the key issue with gun control, as was said by both of the other panelists, is, gun control is basically putting a Band-Aid on a problem that should have been healed much earlier in the story. I mean, there's so much economic hardship and lack of economic educational opportunities and lack of other things for people to get involved in that leads up to the point where someone is getting involved in gun violence. And I think we need to work on all those cultural, socio-political issues to actually cure the disease instead of continuing to put a Band-Aid on it with gun control, although gun control is a necessary measure, perhaps, to add on to that.
Correct.
And do you think that the cities need to work together, Eric, to do a better job of coming up with policies that deal with gun violence? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of commonalities. Just briefly.
Well, can you say, well, they do, but when you have areas of the country and pockets of the country where they have all these militias, how much continuity will there really be?
All right. On that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Ambra Nicole. She blogs at Nicola.com and joined me from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Jay Smooth, who video blogs at IllDoctrine.com. He was at our NPR studios in New York. And Eric Brown, blogger for the Detroit News' political and government blog.